and shorts that barely showed below the tails of the shirt. I couldn't stop my eyes from going straight to her legs, just a quick glance, but enough that she noticed. She looked at me and raised an eyebrow. No hello, no what's up, just a single raised eyebrow. That flustered the hell out of me. I went to the attorney's office today, I stammered. I have the transcripts from the trial. I reached into the backpack and showed her proof of my deed. She remained planted in her doorway, looking up at me, not inviting me in or responding beyond the raised eyebrow. Instead, she studied me as if to size up my intrusion, shrugged, and walked into her apartment, letting the door creak open behind her. I followed her into her apartment, which smelled faintly of baby powder and vanilla. "Have you read them yet?" she asked. "I just got them." I dropped the first volume onto her table, letting it slam down to show its heft. I have no idea where to begin reading these things. "Start with the opening statement," she said.
"The what?"
"The opening statement."
"That should probably be near the beginning, right?"
I asked, grinning. She picked up one of the transcripts and began flipping pages.
"How do you know about opening statements and stuff? Are you pre-law?"
"Maybe," she said, in a matter-of-fact tone. "I was mock trial in high school. The attorney who coached us said that the opening statement should tell the story of the case. Tell it like you're sitting around the living room with friends."
"You were in mock trial?"
"Yeah," she muttered, licking her fingers and flipping more pages. "If all goes well, I wouldn't mind going to law school someday."
"I haven't locked into a major yet, but I'm thinking journalism. It's just that..."
"Here it is." She stood up, creasing the pages back so she could hold the transcript in one hand. "You be the jury, sit on the couch, and I'll be the prosecutor."
I sat in the middle of her couch, spreading my arms out to each side, placing them on the backrest. She stood in front of me and read a few lines to herself to get into character. Then she drew her chest up, pulled her shoulders back, and started to speak. And as she spoke, I watched the pixie in her disappear, and from its shadow stepped a woman with the confidence and poise to command a jury's attention.
"Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, the evidence in this case will show that on October 29th, 1980, the defendant..." Lila waved her arm with the grace of a game show model, pointing toward an empty chair in the corner. "Carl Iverson raped and murdered a 14-year-old girl by the name of Crystal Marie Hagen."
Lila paced slowly in front of me as she read, looking up from her script as often as she could, making eye contact with me, as if I were an actual juror. "Last year, Crystal Hagen was a happy, vivacious 14-year-old girl, a beautiful child, loved by her family and excited to be on the cheerleading squad at Edison High School."
Lila paused and lowered her voice for effect.
"But, ladies and gentlemen, you will learn that not everything was wonderful in Crystal Hagen's life. You will see excerpts from her diary where she writes about a man named Carl Iverson, a man who lived in the house next door to Crystal Hagen. You will see, in her diary, where she calls him the pervert next door. She wrote that Carl Iverson would stare at her from his window and watch her as she practiced her cheerleading routines in her backyard. From that diary, she will tell you about an incident when she was with her boyfriend, a young man she met in her high school typing class, a boy named Andy Fisher. One night she and Andy were parked in the alley that passed behind both Crystal's house and Carl Iverson's house. They were parked at the end of the alley, away from prying eyes, making out, as kids will do. That's when the defendant, Carl Iverson, walked up to the car like a monster in a slasher movie and glared into the window at them. He saw Crystal and Andy, well, let's just say they were experimenting, sexually. Just a couple of kids goofing around. And Carl Iverson saw them. He watched them. Now that may not seem all that bad, but for Crystal Hagen, it was like the end of the world. You see, Crystal had a stepfather, a devoutly religious man named Douglas Lockwood. He'll be testifying in this trial. Mr. Lockwood didn't approve of Crystal being a cheerleader. He didn't like the idea of her dating at the age of 14. So he set out some rules for Crystal, rules to protect the family's reputation and Crystal's modesty. He told her that if she did not live up to those rules, she would not be allowed to continue as a cheerleader. And if the infraction were serious enough, he would send her to a private, religious school.
Ladies and gentlemen, what she did in that car that night with Andy Fisher broke those rules. The evidence will show that Carl Iverson used what he saw in the alley that night to blackmail Crystal, to get her to, well, do his bidding. You see, shortly after that night in the alley, Crystal wrote in her diary that a man was forcing her to do stuff she didn't want to do. Sexual stuff. He told her that if she did not do what he wanted, he was going to expose her secret. Now, Crystal doesn't expressly say that Carl Iverson was the man threatening her, but when you see her words in that diary, it'll leave no doubt in your mind who she's writing about. Lila slowed the cadence of her speech, lowering her voice to little more than a whisper, giving it a dramatic effect. My arms moved from the back of the couch to my knees as I leaned in to hear her. The afternoon of her murder, Andy Fisher drove her home after school. They kissed goodbye, and Andy left. Crystal was all alone in an empty house next door to Carl Iverson. After Andrew drove away, we know that Crystal ended up in Carl Iverson's house. Maybe she went there to confront him. You see, Crystal Hagen met with her school counselor that afternoon and learned that what Carl Iverson was doing to her would send him to prison. Or, maybe, she was there at the point of a gun. Because on the morning of Crystal's death, we know that Carl Iverson bought an army surplus handgun. We're not sure of exactly how she came to be in Iverson's house, but we know that she was there because of evidence that I'll get to in a minute. And once she was there, we know that things went terribly wrong for Crystal Hagen. She had a plan to turn the tables on Iverson, send him to prison if he didn't stop the threats and the abuse. Carl Iverson, of course, had other plans. Lila stopped pacing, no longer pretending to be the prosecutor. She sat down on the couch beside me, her eyes fixed on the transcript. When she continued, she spoke as if she were struck by some profound sadness. Carl Iverson raped Crystal Hagen, and when he finished with her, after he took everything else he could take from her, he took her life. He strangled her using an electrical cord. Ladies and gentlemen, it takes a long time to strangle a person to death. It is a slow, horrible way to die. Carl Iverson had to wrap that cord around Crystal Hagen's throat and pull it tight and hold it there for at least 2 minutes. And as every second passed, he had the ability to change his mind. Instead, he continued to pull on that cord, keeping it tight around her throat, until he was sure that she was not just unconscious, but dead. Lila stopped reading and looked at me with a pained expression, as though I were somehow an extension of Carl, as though some seed of his monstrous deed lived in me. I shook my head. She went back to reading. Crystal fought for her life. We know this because one of her false fingernails broke off during the struggle. That fingernail was found on the steps leading out of Carl Iverson's house. It fell there as Carl Iverson dragged her body to his tool shed. He dumped her body onto the floor of that shed as if she were just a piece of garbage. Then, to try and hide his crime from the world, he set his shed on fire, believing that the heat and the flames would destroy the evidence of what he had done. After he touched a match to that old shed, he went back in his house and drank from a bottle of whiskey until he passed out. By the time the fire trucks got there, the shed was completely engulfed in flames. After police found Crystal's body in that smoldering rubble, they knocked on Mr. Iverson's door, but he didn't answer. They assumed nobody was home. Detective Tracer returned in the morning with a search warrant and found Iverson still passed out on the couch, an empty whiskey bottle in one hand and the .45 caliber pistol near the other. Ladies and gentlemen, you're going to see pictures that will turn your stomach. I apologize in advance for what you're going to see, but it's necessary so that you understand what happened to Crystal Hagen. The fire burned the bottom half of her body so badly that some parts of her body were barely recognizable. The tin from the roof of the shed fell on her, covering her upper torso, protecting that part of her from the worst of the fire. And there, tucked under her chest, you'll see her left hand, unburned. And on the left hand, you'll see the acrylic fingernails that she was so proud of, the nails she had done up for her first homecoming dance with Andy Fisher.
You'll see that one of the nails is missing. The nail that broke off during her fight with Carl Iverson.
Ladies and gentlemen, once you've seen all the evidence in this case, I'll be coming back here to speak with you again. And I'll be asking you to return a verdict of guilty for murder in the first degree against Carl Albert Iverson.
Lila put the transcript on her lap, letting the echo of her words fall silent.
What a sick bastard, she said. I can't believe you can sit with this guy and not want to kill him. They should have never let him out of prison. He should have rotted away in the darkest, dankest cell they have.
I leaned slightly toward her, imitating her posture, and resting one of my hands on the cushion next to her leg. If I had spread my fingers, I could have touched her. That thought erased all others in my head, but she took no notice.
What's it like talking to him? She asked.
He's an old man, I said. He's sick and weak and thin as a whip. It's hard to see him in that stuff you read.
When you write about him, make sure you tell the whole story. Don't just write about the weak old man dying of cancer. Tell them about the drunken degenerate who burned a 14-year-old girl.
I made a promise to write the truth, I said. And I will. Chapter 12. The month of October flew by with the speed and tumult of a falling mountain river. One of Molly's bartenders had to quit because the woman's husband caught her flirting for better tips. Molly had asked me to fill in until she found a replacement. I couldn't refuse because I needed to make up for the $3,000 I wasted on my mom's bail. So, for most of the month, I worked Tuesday through Thursday nights behind the bar and weekend nights at the door. On top of that, I had midterms in my economics and my sociology classes. I fell into the habit of reading only the highlighted lines of my textbooks, used books whose previous owners hopefully had an eye for what was trustworthy. I found a document in Carl's sentencing file that turned out to be a godsend. It was a report that gave a thorough synopsis of Carl Iverson's life growing up in South St. Paul. His family, his petty delinquencies, his hobbies, his education. It touched briefly upon his military service, mentioning that Carl had been honorably discharged from the Army after serving in Vietnam, having been awarded 2 Purple Hearts and a Silver Star. I made a note to myself to explore Carl's military service in more depth. I visited Carl twice in October, just before my notes and opening chapter were due. I managed to finish the first chapter by blending information from the report with the details from my notes, sprinkled liberally with my own creative license. After I turned the assignment into my instructor, I did not go back to Hillview until after Halloween, a holiday I had grown to despise. I dressed up as a bouncer for Halloween, just as I had for every Halloween since I turned 18 and worked the door at Molly's. I broke up only one fight that night, when Superman grabbed the ass of Raggedy Ann, if Raggedy Ann had been a stripper, that is, causing her boyfriend, Raggedy Andy, to beat the Man of Steel to the floor. I rushed Raggedy Andy out the door. Raggedy Ann followed us out, flashing me a coy smile when she passed, as though the fight had been her plan all along, the kind of validation she had hoped for when she tucked her ample, fleshy parts into that tiny costume. I hated Halloween. Cold weather arrived in earnest on the first day of November, the day I went back to Hillview. The temperature barely crested 30 degrees. Dead leaves gathered in the crooks of buildings and around dumpsters where breezes curled. I called that morning to make sure that Carl would be up for a visit, not knowing exactly how pancreatic cancer progresses. I found Carl in his usual spot, staring out the window. He had an afghan covering his lap, thick wool socks under his cotton slippers, and long johns under his blue robe. He was expecting me, and had asked one of the nurses to move a comfortable chair next to his wheelchair. Out of reflex or habit, I shook his hand as I sat down, his thin finger sliding from my palm, cold, limp, like dead seaweed.
"Thought you forgot about me," he said.
"It's been a busy semester," I answered, pulling out my small digital recorder. "You don't mind, do you? It's easier than taking notes."
"This is your show. I'm just killing time."
He chuckled at his own gallows humor. I turned the recorder on and asked Carl to pick up where he'd left off in our last meeting.
As Carl told his stories, I found myself breaking them apart into bits of information, spreading them around like pieces of a jigsaw puzzle on the table. Then I tried to reassemble the pieces in a way that would explain the birth and life of a monster. What was in his childhood and his adolescence that planted the seed that would one day come to define him as Carl the Murderer? There had to be a secret. Something had to have happened to Carl Iverson to make him different from the rest of the human race, different from me. He had given me that sermon about honesty the day we first met, and now he was telling me his Leave It to Beaver upbringing, all the while hiding that dark tangent that shifted his world onto an axis the rest of us could never understand. I wanted to cry bullshit. Instead, I nodded and prodded and listened as he painted his world eggshell white. It was during the second hour of our interview when he said, "And that's when the U.S. government invited me to go to Vietnam." Finally, I thought, an event that might explain the monster. Carl had grown weak from all the talking he was doing, so he put his hands on his lap, leaned back in his wheelchair, and closed his eyes. I watched the scar in his neck pulse as blood passed through his carotid artery. "Is Vietnam where you got that scar?" I asked. He touched the line on his neck.
"No, I got that in prison. The psychopathic Aryan brother tried to cut my head off."
"Aryan brother? Aren't those the white guys?"
"They are," he said.
I thought the different races stuck up for each other in prison.
"Not when you're a convicted child molester, which I was. The different gangs have dibs on the sex offenders of their own race."
"Dibs?"
"Sex offenders are the runts of the prison litter. If you get shit on, you take it out on the runt. If you need to earn a tear tattoo to show you're a tough guy, why not kill the runt? If you need a bitch, well, you get the picture."
I cringed inside but kept my composure so that he wouldn't see my revulsion.
"One day, about 3 months after I got to Stillwater, I was on my way to dinner. That's the most dangerous time of the day. They send 200 guys at a time to the mess hall. In that crowd, the shivs come out. There's no keeping track of who did what to whom."
"Isn't there a place where you can get out of the general population? Oh, what's it called? Protective custody or something like that?"
"Segregation," he said. "Seg, for short. Yeah, I could have asked for seg, but I didn't."
"Why not?"
"Because at that point in my life, living didn't matter all that much to me."
"So how'd you get the scar?"
"There was this big gorilla named Slattery who tried to get me to... well, let's just say he was lonely for some companionship. Said he'd cut my throat if I didn't give him what he wanted. I told him he'd be doing me a favor."
"So he cut your throat?"
"No, that's not how it works. He was a boss, not a worker. He had some punk do it, some kid looking to make a name for himself. I didn't even see it happen. I felt a warm liquid running down my shoulder. I put my hand up to my throat and felt the blood spurting out of my neck. Nearly died. After they patched me up, they forced me into SAG. Stayed there most of the rest of my 30 years. Noisy, surrounded by concrete almost every hour of the day. It could drive a man crazy."
"Is prison where you met your brother?" I asked.
"My brother?"
"Virgil, wasn't that his name?"
"Ah, Virgil."
He took in a deep breath, as if to sigh, and a wave of pain jolted him upright in his chair. The blood drained from his fingers as he gripped the sides of his wheelchair.
"I think,"
he said, tapping out a series of short breaths, as if he were giving birth, waiting for the pain to pass,
"that story's gonna have to wait for another day."
He waved the nurse over, asking her for his medication.
"I'm afraid I'm going to be asleep in a very short while."
I thanked him for his time, picked up my backpack and recorder, and headed out. I stopped briefly at the front desk to fish my wallet out of my pocket and find the business card Virgil Gray had given to me. The time had come for me to hear from the one person in the world who believed Carl to be innocent. The sole voice arguing against my conclusion that Carl Iverson had been justly punished. As I dug out the card, Janet leaned across the reception desk and whispered,
"He didn't take his pain medication today. He wanted to be clear-headed when you came. He'll probably be out of it all day tomorrow."
I didn't respond to Janet. I didn't know what to say. Chapter 13. It had been a couple weeks since I got the call from the public defender's office telling me that the rest of Carl's file had been readied. I felt bad about that. I felt bad because I still hadn't picked it up. Had Virgil Gray not suggested that we meet downtown, that box would likely have stayed at the public defender's office. My assignment was time-consuming enough without having to read a stack of files up to my knee. But when I called Virgil, he suggested that we meet in a small courtyard outside the government center in downtown Minneapolis. And that is where I found him, sitting on a granite bench at the edge of the courtyard, his cane resting against his good leg. He watched me as I crossed the length of the square, not waving or otherwise acknowledging me. "Mr. Gray," I held out my hand. He shook it with the enthusiasm you might show for leftover broccoli. "I appreciate you meeting with me."
"Why are you writing a story?"
Virgil asked bluntly. He didn't look at me when he spoke, his eyes focused on the fountain in the center of the courtyard.
"Excuse me?"
I said.
"Why are you writing his story? What's in it for you?"
I sat on the bench beside Mr. Gray. "I told you, it's an English assignment."
"Yes, but why him? Why Carl? You could write about anyone. Hell, you could make up a story. Your teacher would never know the difference."
"Why not Carl?" I asked. "He has an interesting story to tell."
"You're just using him,"
Virgil said.
"Carl has been screwed over more than any man deserves. I don't think it's right what you're doing."
"Well, if he hasn't been screwed, like you say, wouldn't it be good to have someone tell that story?"
"So that's what you're doing?"
he said, his words dripping with sarcasm.
"That's the story you're telling. You're writing about how Carl got screwed, about how he was convicted for a crime he didn't commit."
"I haven't written any story yet. I'm still trying to figure out what the story is about. That's why I came to see you. You said he's innocent."
"He is innocent."
"Well, so far you're the only one saying that. The jury, the prosecutor, hell, I think his own attorney believed he was guilty."
"That don't make it true."
"You didn't stand up for Carl at his trial. You didn't testify."
"They wouldn't let me testify. I wanted to testify, but they wouldn't let me."
"Who wouldn't let you testify?" Virgil looked up at a sky the color of fireplace ash. The trees around the courtyard had stripped down to their winter skeletons, and a cold wind swept across the cobblestone and up the back of my neck.
"His attorneys," Virgil said, "they wouldn't let me tell the jury about him. They told me that if I testified, it would be character evidence." "I told him damn straight it'd be character evidence. They need to know the real Carl, not that pile of lies the prosecutor was shoveling. They said if I talked about Carl's character, the prosecutor could also talk about Carl's character, about how he drank all day, couldn't keep a job, all that bullshit."
"So what would you have said if you'd testified?" Virgil turned, looking me in the eye, sizing me up one more time, his cold gray irises reflecting the gathering clouds.
"I met Carl Iverson in Vietnam in 1967. We were dumb kids fresh out of boot camp. Did a tour in the jungle with him. Doing things, seeing things that you just can't explain to people who weren't there."
"And in that tour you came to know him well enough to say, without a doubt, that he didn't kill Crystal Hagen? Was he some kind of pacifist?" Virgil narrowed his gaze as if he were getting ready to punch me in the face.
"No," he said. "Carl Iverson was no pacifist."
"So he killed people in Vietnam?"
"Yeah, he killed people. He killed plenty of people."
"I can see why the defense attorney didn't want you testifying."
"It was a war. You kill people in war."
"I still don't understand how telling the jury about Carl killing people in a war could have helped. I would think that if I had been in a war and had killed, what was it you said, plenty of people, that killing would come easier to me."
"There's a lot you don't understand."
"Then make me understand," I said, getting frustrated. "That's why I'm here." Virgil thought for a moment and then reached down, his hands pinching the fabric of his khaki pants near his right knee, slid his trousers up, and exposed the shiny metal prosthesis that I had seen the day we first met. The artificial leg extended all the way up to his mid-thigh, a white plastic kneecap covering a spring-loaded hinge the size of a fist. Virgil tapped on his metal shin.
See this?
He asked.
This is Carl's doing.
Carl's the reason you lost your leg?
No.
He smiled.
Carl's the reason I'm here to tell you about my missing leg. Carl's the reason I'm alive today.
Virgil slid his trouser leg back down, leaning forward, resting his elbows on his thighs.
It was May of 1968. We were stationed at a little fire base on a ridge northwest of the Quezon Valley. We received orders to toss a village, some no-name collection of huts,
until it spotted Viet Cong activity in the area. So they sent our platoon in to check it out.
I was walking point along with this kid.
A nostalgic smile crossed Virgil's face.
Tater Davis. Dumb kid used to follow me around like a basset hound.
Virgil took a moment more to remember before he continued.
So, me and Tater were walking point.
Point? I asked. Like, out in front?
Yeah. They put a man or two out ahead of the rest of the column. That's the point. It's a hell of a plan. If things go bad, the army would rather lose two fellows than a whole platoon.
I looked at Virgil's leg. I take it things went badly?
Yep,
he said.
We came over a small rise where the trail cut through a rocky knoll. On the downhill side of the knoll, the trees thinned out a bit, enough to see the village ahead. Tater picked up the pace once he saw the village, but something wasn't right. I can't say I saw anything in particular. Maybe it was a feeling, maybe subconsciously I saw something, but whatever it was, I knew something wasn't right. I signaled for the platoon to hold up. Tater saw me and put his rifle at the ready. I walked ahead on my own, maybe 20 or 30 paces. I was just about to give the all's clear when the jungle exploded with gunfire. It was something else, I tell you. Ahead of me, beside me, behind me, hell, that jungle lit up with muzzle flashes from everywhere. The first bullet I took busted my shoulder blade. About that same time, two rounds caught my leg. One shattered my knee. The other busted my femur. I dropped without firing a single shot. I heard my prick of a sergeant, this piece of shit named Gibbs, ordering the platoon back over the knoll to take up defensive positions. I opened my eyes to see my buddy scampering away from me, jumping behind rocks and trees. Tater was running with all his might to make it back to the platoon. And that's when I saw Carl running toward me.
Virgil stopped talking as he watched the past play out through the tears that had welled up in his eyes. He reached into his pocket, pulled out a handkerchief, and dabbed it to his eyes, his hand trembling slightly. I looked away to give Virgil some privacy. People in finely pressed suits crossed the courtyard in front of us, heading to and from the government center, ignoring the one-legged man sitting next to me. I waited patiently for Virgil to compose himself, and when he did, he continued.
Carl came running up the trail, screaming like a madman, firing at the muzzle flashes in the tree line. I could hear Sergeant Gibbs screaming at Carl, telling him to fall back.
When Tater saw Carl, he stopped retreating and jumped behind a tree. Carl got to me and dropped down on one knee, putting himself between me and about 40 AK-47s. He stayed there, firing his rifle until he was about out of rounds. Virgil took in a slow breath, again on the verge of tears.
You should have seen him. He picked my rifle up with his left hand as he squeezed off the final rounds from his rifle, firing both guns at the same time. Then he dropped his M16 across my chest and went on firing mine. I popped a fresh magazine into his rifle and handed it back to him in time to reload my rifle again.
Did Carl get hit?
He took a bullet through his bicep, on his left arm. Another one cut a crease in his helmet. And another took the heel off his boot, but he never budged. It was a sight.
I bet it was, I said. Virgil looked at me for the first time since he started telling his story.
Have you ever seen those old movies?
He said,
where the sidekick gets shot and he tells the hero to go on without him to save himself.
Yeah, I said.
Well, I was that sidekick. I was as good as dead, and I knew it. I opened my mouth to tell Carl to save himself, but what came out was... Don't leave me here.
Virgil looked at his fingertips, which were folded together on his lap.
I was scared,
he said,
more scared than I had ever been in my whole life. Carl had done everything wrong.
Militarily speaking, that is. He was saving my life. He was willing to die for me, and all I could do was tell him, don't leave me here. I've never been so ashamed.
I wanted to say something comforting or to pat him on the shoulder, to let him know that it was okay. But that would have been an insult. I wasn't there. I had no say in what was or wasn't okay.
When the battle was at its worst,
he said, the entire platoon was firing to beat hell. The VC were dealing it back in spades with Tater and Carl and me right in the middle of it all. I looked up and watched torn up leaves and the splinters from the trees falling like confetti. The tracer rounds crisscrossing above us. Red from our guns, green from theirs. Noise and dirt and smoke. It was amazing, like I was outside of what was happening. The pain was gone. The fear was gone. I was ready to die. I looked over and saw Tater crouched behind a tree, laying down fire as best he could. He emptied his magazine and reached for a new one. Right then, he took a bullet in the face and fell dead. That's the last thing I remember before losing consciousness.
You don't know what happened after that? I asked.
I was told that we had air support hovering above the mission. They dropped a load of napalm on the VC position. Carl covered me like a blanket. If you look closely, you can still see scars on the back of his arms and neck from the burn he took.
Was that the end of the war for you two? I asked.
It was for me, Virgil said, clearing the choke out of his throat. We got patched up at the fire base first, and then was off to Da Nang. They sent me to Seoul. But Carl never made it past Da Nang. He spent some time recovering and then went back to the company.
The jury never got to hear that story? I said.
Not a word of it.
It's an amazing story, I said.
Carl Iverson is a hero. A true goddamn hero. He was willing to lay down his life for me. He's not a rapist. He didn't kill that girl.
I hesitated before I said my next thought. But that story doesn't prove that Carl is innocent. Virgil shot me a cold stare that bore into my temples, his grip on his cane tightening as if he were preparing to beat me with it for my insolence. I didn't move or say a word as I waited for the anger behind his eyes to thaw.
You sit here, all warm and safe, he sneered. You have no idea what it's like to face your own death.
He was wrong. I didn't feel warm. And with his knuckles turning white as he gripped the handle of his cane, I didn't feel particularly safe, although he had a point about the facing death part. People can change, I said.
A man doesn't jump in front of a hail of bullets one day and murder a little girl the next,
he said. But you weren't with him for the rest of his tour, were you? You flew home and he stayed there. Maybe something happened. Something that turned a screw in his head, made him the kind of guy that could kill that girl. You said yourself that Carl was a killer in Vietnam.
Yeah, he was a killer in Vietnam, but that's different than murdering that girl.
Virgil's words brought back the first conversation that I'd had with Carl, how cryptic he'd been about the distinction between killing and murdering. I thought Virgil might be able to help me understand, so I asked. Carl said there's a difference between killing and murdering. What does he mean by that? I thought I knew the answer, but I wanted to hear it from Virgil before I talked to Carl about it.
It's like this, he said. You kill a soldier in the jungle, and you're just killing. It's not murder. It's like there's an agreement between armies that killing each other is okay. It's allowed. That's what you're supposed to do. Carl killed men in Vietnam, but he didn't murder that girl. See what I'm saying?
I see that you owe your life to Carl Iverson, and that you have his back no matter what. But Carl told me he'd done both. He killed and he murdered. He said he was guilty of both. Virgil looked at the ground, his face softening with some thought that seemed trapped in his head. He rubbed the stubble on his chin with the back of his index finger and then nodded as if he had come to some silent conclusion.
There is another story,
he said.
I'm all ears, I said. It's a story I can't tell you,
he said.
I swore to Carl that I would never tell anyone,
I never have, and I never will.
But if it helps to clear...
It's not my story to tell. It's Carl's. It's his decision. He's never told a soul, not his lawyer, not the jury. I begged him to talk about it at his trial, but he refused.
It happened in Vietnam?
It did.
He said. And it shows what? I asked. Virgil bristled at my question.
For some reason, Carl seems interested in talking to you. I don't understand it, but he seems willing to let you in. Maybe he'll tell you about what happened to him in Vietnam. If he does talk about it, you'll see. There's no way in hell Carl Iverson could have killed that girl.
Chapter 14. After my meeting with Virgil, I stopped by the public defender's office to pick up the rest of the file, carrying it home on my shoulder, my mind juggling the competing sides of Carl Iverson. On the one side, Carl was a man kneeling in a jungle, taking bullets for his friend. On the other side was a sick bastard capable of extinguishing the life of a young girl in order to satiate his deviant sexual desires. Two sides, one man. Somewhere in the box on my shoulder, there had to be an explanation of how the first man became the second. The box seemed impossibly heavy as I mounted the staircase to my apartment. As I reached the top step, Lila opened her door, saw me, pointed at the box on my shoulder, and asked, "What's that?"
"It's the rest of Carl's file," I said. "I just picked it up."
Her eyes lit up with excitement.
"Can I see it?" she said.
Ever since Lila had read the prosecutor's opening statement in the transcript, Carl's case had become my lure, the key to getting Lila into my apartment so I could spend time with her. I would have been lying if I said that my interest in digging deeper into Carl Iverson's story didn't have a lot to do with my attraction to Lila. We went to my apartment and started digging through the box, which held a few dozen folders of varying thicknesses, each with the name of a different witness or a label like forensics or photos or research. Lila pulled out a file labeled Diary. I pulled out another with the words Autopsy Photos written on the flap. I remember the prosecutor's warning in his opening statement about the intensity of the photos. I remembered as well the words of Carl's public defender, Berthel Collins, and his reaction the first time he saw the photos. I needed to see those photos. Not in the sense that I required their viewing for my project. I needed to understand what happened to Crystal Hagen. I needed to put a face to the name, flesh to the bone. I needed to test my mettle, to see if I could handle it. The autopsy photo folder was one of the thinnest in the box, containing maybe a couple dozen 8x10 pictures. I took a breath, closed my eyes, and prepared myself for the worst. I raised the folder cover quickly, like tearing off a bandage, and opened my eyes to see a beautiful young girl smiling at me. It was Crystal Hagen's freshman picture. Her long blonde hair, parted in the middle, curled back along the frame of her face, emulated Farrah Fawcett, as did most of the girls at that time. She smiled a perfect smile, white teeth glistening behind soft lips, her eyes sparkling with a hint of mischief. She was a beautiful girl, the kind of girl that a young man would want to love and an old man should want to protect. This would be the picture that the prosecutor would have propped up in front of the jurors to make them feel for the victim. There would be other pictures he would use to make them despise the accused. I stared at Crystal's picture for several minutes. I tried to imagine her alive, going to school, worrying about grades or boys or the myriad inconsequential anxieties that seem so overwhelming to a teenager and so mundane to an adult. I tried to imagine her as an adult, aging her from the freshman cheerleader with the long, flowing locks to the middle-aged mother with practical hair and a minivan. I felt sorry that she was dead. I turned to the next picture, gasping, as my heart seized up inside my chest. I slapped the file folder closed to wait for my breath to return. Lila was reading her file, the diary entries, so intensely that she didn't notice my jolt. I had only seen the image for a second, long enough for it to become seared on the back of my eyelids. I opened the file again. I had expected her hair to be gone. It doesn't take much heat to burn hair. What I didn't expect was for her lips to be burned off. Her teeth, bright white in her class photo, now protruded from her jawbone, stained yellow by the fire. She lay on her right side,
exposing the melted tissue of what used to be her left ear and cheek and her nose. Her face was nothing more than a tight black mask of charred skin. As the burning muscles in her neck contracted, her face had twisted around to look over her left shoulder in a grotesque expression that mimicked a scream. Her legs were bent in a fetal position, and the meat of her thighs and calves had fused to the bone, burnt and shriveled like beef jerky. Both her feet had been burned down to stumps. The fingers of her right hand curled into her wrist, which tucked into her biceps and chest. All her joints had knotted up as the heat from the fire shrank the cartilage and tendons. I could see where a sheet of tin had fallen across her body, protecting part of her torso from the worst of the flames. I swallowed back a gag in my esophagus and turned to the next picture, which showed Crystal rolled onto her back, her body frozen in a curl. The medical examiner held Crystal's left wrist in one of his latex-gloved hands. The skin on her left hand had been better protected, having been trapped under her body. In the medical examiner's other hand, between his thumb and forefinger, he held the broken fingernail by its edges, matching it up with the other fingernails on her left hand. It was the fake nail that they found on the steps leading from Carl's house to his shed. I closed the file. Had Crystal's family seen these pictures? They had to have. They attended the trial. These photos were trial exhibits, probably blown up to a size that could be viewed across a large courtroom. What had it been like to sit in that courtroom and see these pictures, the mutilation of their beautiful daughter? How could they not charge over the bar separating the gallery from the defendant and rip out the man's throat? It would have taken more than an old bailiff with a baton to stop me if this had been my sister. I took a deep breath, opening the file once again to Crystal's school picture. I felt my heart rate mellow, my breathing returning to normal. Wow, I thought. I had never had such a visceral reaction to a picture. The juxtaposition of the pretty, vibrant cheerleader with the charred corpse made me happy that Carl had rotted for decades in prison, and it made me regret that Minnesota forbids putting criminals to death. If those pictures had that effect on me, they must have had a similar effect on Carl's jury. There was no way Carl was going to walk out of that courtroom a free man. It was the least the jury could do to avenge Crystal's death. Just then, my cell phone rang, interrupting my thoughts. I recognized the 507 area code from Austin, but not the number. "Hello?" I said. "Joe?" came a man's voice. "This is Joe. It's Terry Bremer." "Hi, Mr. Bremer." I smiled at hearing the familiar name. Terry Bremer owned the duplex where Mom and Jeremy lived, where I used to live. At that thought, my smile faded. "Is something wrong?" "We had a small incident here," he said. "Your brother tried to heat up a piece of pizza in the toaster." "Is he okay?" "He's fine, I think. He set off the smoke detectors. Mrs. Albers from next door came over to check on him because the alarm didn't stop. She found your brother curled up in his room. He's really freaked out here. He's rocking back and forth and rubbing his hands." "Where's my mother?" "Not here," Bremer said. "Your brother mentioned something about her going to some meeting yesterday. She hasn't come back yet." I wanted to hit something. I balled my hand into a fist and drew it back, my eyes focused on a smooth section of wall just itching to be pounded. But I knew that would be nothing but a ticket to bruised knuckles and forfeiture of my damage deposit. It certainly would not make my mother grow up. It wouldn't bring Jeremy back from his panic. I took a deep breath, lowered my head, and unclenched my fist. I turned to Lila, who was looking up at me with a worried expression. She had heard enough of the conversation to figure out what had happened. "Go," she said. I nodded, grabbed my coat and my keys, and headed out the door. Chapter 15. Terry Bremer stood on bowed legs and carried a tin of chew in his back pocket. A good old boy who owned a bowling alley, two bars, and a couple dozen apartment units in Austin. He was one of those guys who could have been at the helm of a multinational corporation had his wall held the sheepskin of Harvard Business School instead of Austin High School. As landlords go, he was a good guy, affable, responsive. He'd given me my first bouncer job at a little hole in the wall he owned called the Piedmont Club. It happened a couple weeks after I turned 18. He'd come around for the rent that my mother had blown on a trip to an Indian casino the week before. Instead of yelling or threatening to kick us out, he hired me to watch the door, clear off tables, and haul kegs up from the cellar. It was a good deal for me because it put money in my pocket and taught me how to deal with angry drunks and idiots. It was a good deal for him because if my mom blew our rent money, he simply withheld it from my check. "Is my mother back yet?" I asked when I walked into the apartment. Mr. Bremer stood just inside the door like a sentinel, waiting to be relieved of duty.
"No," he said. "And by the looks of things, she hasn't been around since yesterday."
He took his cap off and brushed his palm across the smooth skin of his bald head.
"I gotta tell you, Joe, Mrs. Albers was on the verge of calling social services. Jeremy could have burned the place down."
"I know, Mr. Bremer, it won't..."
"I can't be getting sued, Joe. Your mom leaving him alone like that?"
"If he burns the place down, I'll get sued. Your mother can't leave a retard home alone like that."
"He's not a retard," I snapped. "He's autistic."
I didn't mean nothing by it, Joe.
"But you know what I'm saying. Now that you're off at college, there's no one around to keep things in line."
"I'll talk to her," I said.
"I can't have this happen again, Joe. If it does, I gotta kick him out."
"I'll talk to her," I said again, a little more insistent. Mr. Bremer put on his coat, paused as if to continue the conversation to make sure he'd made his point, then must have thought better of it, and headed out the door. I found Jeremy in his room.
"Hey, buddy," I said.
Jeremy looked up at me, started to smile, but then stopped, his eyes falling to the corner of the room, and his brow taking on that worried expression he wore when life didn't make sense to him.
"I heard you had a little excitement here tonight," I continued.
"Hi, Joe,"
he responded. "Did you try and cook your own supper?"
"Maybe I tried to make some pizza."
"You know you can't make pizza in the toaster, don't you?"
"Maybe I'm not allowed to use the stove when Mom is not home."
"Speaking of that, where is Mom?"
"Maybe she had a meeting."
"Is that what she said? Did she tell you she had a meeting?"
"Maybe she said she had to go to a meeting with Larry."
"Larry? Who's Larry?"
Jeremy sent his gaze back to the corner of the room. It was his signal that I'd asked a question for which he had no answer.
I stopped asking questions. It was getting near 10 o'clock. Jeremy liked to be in bed by 10, so I had him brush his teeth and get ready. I waited in the doorway to his bedroom as he changed into his sleeping clothes. When he took off his sweatshirt, I saw the faint shadow of a bruise across his back.
"Hold up there, buddy," I said,
walking over to get a better look at what I thought I'd seen. The bruise, about 6 inches in length, and the width of a broom handle, started just under his shoulder blade and extended to his spinal cord.
"What's this?"
Jeremy looked into the corner of the room and didn't answer. Feeling the blood in my cheeks heating up, I took a deep breath to calm myself, knowing that Jeremy would shut down if I became angry. I smiled at him, letting him know that he wasn't in trouble.
"How'd you get this bruise?" I asked.
He continued to look at the corner of the room, saying nothing. I sat down with Jeremy on the edge of the bed, resting my elbows on my knees, pausing for a bit to make sure I was calm.
"Jeremy," I said, "it's very important that you and I don't keep secrets from each other. I'm your brother. I'm here for you. You're not in any trouble. But you can't keep secrets from me. You gotta tell me what happened."
"Maybe..."
His eyes darted from one fixed point to another as he struggled to decide what to do.
"Maybe Larry hit me."
I clenched my fists, but my face remained calm.
"See?" I said. "You didn't do anything wrong. You're not in trouble. How did he hit you?"
"Maybe he hit me with the remote control."
"He hit you with the remote? The TV remote? Why?"
Again, Jeremy averted his gaze. I had asked one question too many. I wanted to put my hands on Jeremy's shoulders and let him know that everything was okay, but you can't do that with Jeremy. I smiled at him and told him to get some sleep and have good dreams. I started his movie up, shut off the light, and closed the door. Whoever this Larry was, he and I were going to have a talk. Chapter 16. The next day was a Saturday. I woke before Jeremy and made pancakes. After we ate, we headed downtown to buy Jeremy a cell phone, one of those cheap ones that let you add minutes when you need them. When we got back to the apartment, I programmed my phone number into his contact list, making my number the only number on his list. I showed him how to call me, how to turn it on, how to find my number, and how to press the send button. He had never had his own phone before, so we practiced. I told him to hide the phone behind his dresser. After that, I let him beat me in 2 games of checkers to distract him from his new phone. Then I had him find the phone and call me to make sure he remembered how to do it. He did. "If anyone tries to hurt you," I said, "if this Larry hits you or does anything like that, you call me. You got a phone of your own now. You call me. Okay, Jeremy?"
"Maybe I will call you with my new phone," he said, smiling with pride.
After lunch, we played some more checkers and then turned on a movie. His movie. As Jeremy watched the movie, I watched the street, waiting for my mother to drive up. I also watched the clock. I had to work at Molly's at 7. The last time I'd bailed on Molly, she told me that I would not be getting any more breaks, and if I didn't show up, I would be fired. My mom left her cell phone in her dresser drawer. I know this because that's where it rang when I tried to call her. With the drive time to the Twin Cities, I would need to leave Austin by 4:30. As I watched the hands of the clock slide past 3 p.m., I asked Jeremy, "Did Mom say when she was going to be back from her meeting?" Jeremy pulled his attention from the movie and concentrated hard, his eyes moving back and forth slowly as if reading lines on a page.
"Maybe she didn't say," he said.
I found a deck of cards and started playing solitaire on the coffee table. I lost 3 hands in quick succession, unable to focus my attention anywhere other than the driveway. As the clock inched close to 4 o'clock, I began going through options in my head. I could take Jeremy back to my apartment, but when I was working or in class, he was apt to find trouble there as easily as he would find it here. I could ask Lila to watch him, but he wasn't her responsibility. For that matter, he wasn't supposed to be my responsibility. I could leave him here, alone, but one more problem and Bremer would follow through on his threat to kick them out. Or I could cancel on Molly again and lose my job. I reshuffled my cards and started laying out a new hand of solitaire. At 5 minutes before 4 o'clock, my mother pulled into the driveway. I turned up the volume on the television to drown out the yelling that would be coming from the front yard, and I headed out the door.
"Where have you been?"
I said through gritted teeth. I don't know if it was my tone, my presence at her apartment, or her double vodka lunch that confused her, but she stared at me as though she had just woken up from a deep sleep.
"Joey," she said, "I didn't see your car."
A tall man with stringy gray hair and a body shaped like a bowling pin stood behind her, curling his upper lip in a snarl. I recognized Larry. I had thrown him out of the Piedmont about a year earlier for getting drunk and slapping a woman.
"You left him alone," I said. "He nearly burned the place down. Where the hell you been?"
"Now you just hold on,"
Larry said, brushing past my mother.
"Don't you talk to your mother like..."
Larry raised his right hand, as if reaching to poke me in the chest. That was the exact wrong thing to do. Before his finger could touch me, I shot my right hand across my chest, grabbing the back of his hand and curling my fingers around the pinky side of his palm. In one swift motion, I ripped his hand away from my chest, twisting it clockwise and dropping Larry to his knees. The move was called a wristlock takedown. One of the regulars at the Piedmont, a cop we called Smiley, showed me that move. It had always been one of my favorites. With very little torque, I curled Larry into a ball, his face a few inches from the ground, his arm cocked skyward behind his back, his wrist wrenched forward in my hand. It took everything I had not to kick Larry in the teeth. I leaned down over him and grabbed a tuft of his hair. His ears turned red and his features contorted as he winced with pain. Behind me, my mother screeched some nonsense about how it was an accident and how Larry was really a good guy deep down. Her pleading evaporated into the air around me, no more important to me than traffic noise in the distance. I pressed Larry's nose and forehead into the grit of the sidewalk.
"I know what you did to my brother," I said.
Larry didn't respond, so I gave the pressure point in his wrist a tweak, and he grunted.
"Let me be very clear about this," I said. "If you ever touch Jeremy again, I will come down on you like nothing you've ever known. Nobody touches my brother, do you understand?" "Fuck you," he said. "Wrong answer," I said, lifting his face off the concrete and tapping it back down just hard enough to make a mark and draw some blood. "I said, do you understand?"
"Yes,"
he said.
I jerked Larry to his feet and shoved him toward the street. He walked down to the curb, holding his bleeding nose and forehead, saying something under his breath that I couldn't hear. I turned my attention back to my mother. Mr. Bremer called me.
We just went to the casino, she said. We were only gone a couple days. What were you thinking? You can't leave him alone for a couple days. He's 18 years old now, she said.
He's not 18, I said. He'll never be 18. That's the point. When he's 40, he'll still be a 7-year-old. You know that.
I'm entitled to have some fun too, ain't I?
You're his mother, for God's sakes. My contempt seethed in my words.
You can't just run off whenever you want to. And you're his brother, she shot back, trying to gain some footing in the argument. But that don't stop you from running off, does it, big college boy?
I stopped talking until the boil in my chest dropped to a simmer, my stare falling on my mother as hard and as cold as winter metal.
Bremer said he's kicking you out if he gets another call.
I turned to walk to my car, my eye on Larry as I passed him, waiting for an excuse to light into him again. As I pulled away from the curb, I saw Jeremy standing at the front window. I waved to him, but he didn't wave back. He just stood there, watching me. To the rest of the world, he would have appeared expressionless, but I knew better. He was my brother, and I was his. And only I could see the sadness behind his calm, blue eyes. Chapter 17. The next morning, I was pulled from a bad dream by a knock at my door. In my dream, I was back in high school, wrestling at a tournament, trying to execute a simple escape maneuver. As I ripped the guy's grip from around my stomach, another hand grabbed my chest, and yet another hand pulled at my arm. I pried each new hand loose, only to create two more hands, like a hydra growing new heads. Soon I could only twist and scream under the onslaught of hands pulling and tearing at me. That's when I heard the noise that woke me. It took a while to purge the cloud of sleep from my head. I sat up in bed, not sure of what I had heard, waiting, listening. Then another knock. I hadn't dreamt it. I threw on a pair of shorts and a sweatshirt and opened the door to find Lila on the other side, holding two cups of coffee and a file folder.
I read the diary, she said, walking past me, handing me one of the cups of coffee.
You do drink coffee, don't you?
Yeah, I drink coffee, I said.
I grabbed a baseball cap from a hook on the wall to cover up my bedhead and followed Lila to the couch. I had left the box of files with Lila in my apartment 2 days earlier when I charged out to go to Austin. She took some of the files home, including the one marked diary, to comb through in my absence.
I read her diary last night, she said.
Crystals? Lila looked at me like I was an idiot. In my defense, I was still groggy with sleep. She turned back to her train of thought.
The diary starts out in May of 1980, Lila said, laying her notes on the coffee table in front of me. The first few months are full of normal teenage crap. She's excited about starting high school one day and scared about it the next. For the most part, she's a happy kid. She has 15 entries about Carl between June and September, usually referring to him as the pervo next door or creepy Carl.
What did she say about him? I asked. Lila had marked some of the pages with yellow tabs. She turned to the first tab in the diary, which was dated June 15th. June 15th. I was practicing in the backyard and saw creepy Carl watching me from his window. I flipped him off and he just stood there. What a pervo.
Just like the prosecutor said, Lila commented, turning to the next tab. He's watching me again. He stared at me while I did my routines. There's one.
She turned the pages of the diary to another marked passage.
Here it is.
September 8th. Creepy Carl was watching me again from the window. He wasn't wearing a shirt. I bet he wasn't wearing pants, either. Lila looked at me for a response. I shrugged. I could see why the prosecutor liked the diary. I think Lila wanted more of a reaction from me, but I moved on.
What else you got?
Most of August is tame, Lila said. When school starts, she meets that guy, Andrew Fisher, in her typing class. She writes all about her plan to get Andy to invite her to homecoming, which he did. Then around mid-September, the entries started getting darker. Read this one,
September 19th. Parking in the alley with Andy. Just when things were getting interesting, creepy Carl walks up and looks in the window like he's Lurch or something. I could have died.
Again, just like the prosecutor told the jury, I said. Carl caught him getting it on in the alley.
2 days later, she starts writing about something bad happening, but she writes some of it in code.
Code?
Yeah. There are a few passages where Crystal uses a substitution code, you know, writing numbers instead of letters.
Lila pulled a stack of diary pages out of the folder. She had marked the coded entries with green post-it tabs.
Look here.
Lila showed me an entry dated September 21st. It began with the words, "Terrible day today." That phrase was followed by 13 numbers, separated by commas, but no spaces, to show where the words might begin or end. None of the numbers exceeded 26, which made it a safe bet that these were numbers in place of letters, the kind of thing a 14-year-old girl would do. After the numbers, the next line read, "I am freaking out. This is very, very bad."
"What's it mean?"
I asked.
"Did I mention it's a code?"
Lila said.
Maybe this was Crystal's way of making sure that if her stepdad ever found the diary, she wouldn't get shipped off to private school.
"Yeah, but it's the code of a 14-year-old girl," I said. "Did you try matching the numbers up with letters?"
"You mean like A equals 1 and B equals 2, that sort of thing?"
Lila rolled her eyes and pulled out the notebook pages where she'd been matching up numbers with letters.
"I tried the alphabet forward, I tried it backward, I tried shifting so that A started at the number 2, then 3, and so on. I tried matching the most frequent number with the letter E or T, because those are the most often used letters in the alphabet. I looked for clues in her diary. I came up with nothing but gibberish."
"Did you try online?" I asked. "I think there are websites that can break codes."
"I thought of that too," she said. "Crystal didn't leave spaces between her words, so it's just strings of numbers. Nothing I found on the internet could solve it. There are 8 billion possible combinations of numbers and letters."
8 billion? I said. "Holy crap."
"Exactly. She must have had a key hidden away, or maybe she memorized a pattern to match the letters to the numbers. Either way, I can't figure it out."
Lila spread the pages on the table.
"There are only 7 coded entries, the last one written on the day she was murdered. I put them together," she said, laying her own list on top of the diary pages.
The first entry was the one from September 21st that she'd already shown me. After that, an entry on September 28th began with 23 missing letters, followed by, "If I don't do what he wants, he'll tell everyone. He'll ruin my life." On September 30th, an entry had 16 missing letters, and the words, "I hate him. I feel sick."